This is cargo here for you.
So how hard was it to come up with a follow-up to, you know, the first films, especially how successful it was?
Well, I mean, it's whenever you're doing a horror sequel, it's really tough. Horror sequels are very different from other kinds of sequels in that you're trying to scare people with the unknown. What, you know, you're trying to unravel a story that, you know, and a mythology that they're not necessarily familiar with. And then once you've done that, now you have to repeat that. And there's really great horror sequels and there's really bad horror sequels. And typically, like, we sat down and we kind of made a list of our favorite horror sequels, the ones we felt were the most effective, that really worked, that we may have even liked better than the first one. Then we made a list of the ones that didn't work, and we tried to break down. Scott and I love dissecting movies, and we broke down what worked about the good films and what didn't work about the bad ones. And what we found was the running thread of the of bad sequels is a movie in which the audience already knows what's going on, but the protagonists don't. And they spend the first two acts just sitting there going, come on, we know that it's death coming for them. That they skirt, you know, show us what it is. And like one of the best examples was Final Destination, you know, where, you know, the Final Destination 2 is such a great sequel. It expands the mythology and it makes it bigger and it makes the first film better. Like the first time I saw Final Destination, I was like, that was a good movie. It's not great, but good. And then you see the sequel, and the sequel's so good and expands on the mythology of the first one. You go back and watch the first one and see all this stuff there. You're like, oh, man, this is, whether it was intentional or not, I like this movie so much more now. And one of the things it does is it gets the characters on the page very early. So they know what's going on, but they don't know their part in it. And now the mystery is expanding that mythology. And so that's what we tried to do here is we said, you know, what if... you know, we struggle with it for a while. How do we go about it? How do we not just make, here's the next family moving into the house so that we can spend an hour of them watching things go bump in the night and going, what's going on? While the audience is going, it's Bagul, for fuck's sake. Oh my God. So what we did is we were like, well, what if between the last film and this film, Deputy So-and-So has caught up and believes in Bagul? What if he, because he's already proven in the first film that he was a much better investigator than Ellison was. And so why not have him caught up with the audience and then have him point out to the audience that, hey, by the way, we never told you how to stop Bagul. We never told you how to, how this works. You don't actually know how the kids get seduced. We don't know any, you think you know the story of Bagul, but actually there's a whole lot of holes still to fill. And now he's going to figure those out and learning those as you're learning them. And so the audience is caught up and hopefully invested in the story. So the big struggle was trying to figure out how to do that. And we spent months kicking back ideas of story elements and we wanted to work so-and-so in, but how do we work him in? And then we had that, you know, eureka moment of, well, we make him the protagonist. You know, we make him the main character this time. And he's not just the character that shows up every so often like he was in the first film. Now, this is his film. And then you can go back and watch the first film and it's almost like the first film is his origin story in the background while you're then setting up this character that will then take the lead in the second film.
Well, we've been discussing, I don't know, she and I are in agreement that the a-hole husband kind of like, you know, he became the focus of attention because after a while, it was, for me, it was like the boogeyman's cool, but hey, we got to get this guy. And then when he burns at the end, I was cheering.
That was exactly what we were going for. It was, you know, the thing is one of the things that Scott and I have always held is that the greatest horror films ever made are films that are about people and about characters and about families and about real things. So you care about that and you get invested in those characters. And as a result, you then care about what happens to them. So you're afraid for them. And it becomes visceral. The worst horror films, you know, the schlock slasher films of the 80s, which I adore, became fun instead of scary because we're just throwing stereotypes out into the woods and then having another stereotype hunt it down and kill it in creative ways. So the villain becomes the hero. So one of the things we focused on with both the Sinister films is talking about family dysfunction and talking about, you know, the breakdown of the American family, because that's what drives Bagul. Bagul is very much driven by families that don't work, and he rips those families apart. That's how you seduce a child into doing this, is they have to already be broken in some way. He doesn't break them. He just preys upon what's already there. And we love the idea of having the second villain in the film and having Clint be this just evil, vile guy. In fact, we had to pull back on it. There were a number of different drafts in the script in which Clint was just too over the top and just too evil, and we hated him just so much. And but we knew that we needed to hate him, and we wanted the audience to cheer when that happened. We wanted the audience to enjoy that moment when he gets his comeuppance, which he totally earns, because we knew we needed to have that moment and that moment of release. And then all of a sudden now, well, that's out of the way, and now we're scared for the rest of the characters. And, oh, God, well, they're going to kill him. Anyone can be killed. And so that was very much what we were going for. So I'm really glad you guys connected with it.
How did you go about the casting?
Well, I was not intimately involved with that. I'm actually based in Austin, Texas, so I do all my writing from Austin, and Scott does all the kind of LA legwork. I'm very fortunate in that he gets to go to meetings and I get to phone in, so I do take a lot of meetings in my bathrobe. But so, but they would contact me every once in a while and be like, "Hey, what do you think of so and so?" I say so and so, but yeah, I mean, one of the main things of casting was during the interim between Sinister and the time we wrote Sinister 2, me and James Ranzone stayed in touch, and he would text me every once in a while and it'd be like, "Hey, dude, so is there a part for so and so in part 2?" And I'd just be like, "Yeah, you'll see. So when he got the script and realized he was the protagonist, he had no idea that was coming. So we already had our protagonist. And then they went about, looking for, the next step was finding the right mom. And so then they started auditioning actresses, and they found Shannon. And I was really excited about that. Back when I was a film critic, when I was doing this, what you guys are doing now and doing roundtables and such, I was a cub reporter at Ain't It Cool News in 2001, and got my first out-of-town LA assignment. And we'd been invited to a press junket. And while we were out here, the guy I was with, Quint, Eric Vespi, he was friends with Roger Avery. And Roger had said, "Well, hey, I love you guys. I love reading Cargill stuff. Why don't you guys come out and visit the set of my new movie? It's called Rules of Attraction. We'd love to you guys to do a set visit." So we went out to Rules of Attraction, which of course was Shannon's second film. And the cast was all, they were all these young up-and-comers. It's Kate Bosworth and Shannon Sossaman and Jessica Biel and James Vanderbeek, who was the big star at the time. And, Kip Pardue, and I didn't get to see too much of Kip. He was one of the only guys that wasn't around, but everyone else was hanging out together. They were literally they would have lunch together every day. They'd be sitting out on the lawn, and so, you know, I was the same age as them, so they were just like, "Hey, why don't you come have lunch with us?" And so I spent 3 days hanging out with these folks and got to know Shannon on the set and just fell in love with her because she's just an amazing woman. And so I, followed her career after that. So when they called me up and they said, "What do you think of Shannon Sossaman?" I'm like, "I love her." Yes, absolutely, Shannon Sossaman. So, yeah, and so I was like, okay, bucket list, wrote a Shannon Sossaman movie. And not when I was writing it, but then when it happened, it's like, all right, bucket list item, you are off the, now to move on to the next bucket list item. But yeah, so, and then of course, after that, it was trying to find the right actor to play Clint. Because we needed someone who could evoke that menace. And of course, the big challenge was finding the kids. In fact, that's something that Kieran and I went back and forth on for a while, because he was like, okay, do they have to be identical twins? Could they be fraternal twins? And I'm like, they could, but no. And he's like, it's hard enough finding one good kid actor. And he's like, I know this, it's hard enough to find that, but to find twins that are good enough, because we don't have time to shoot one actor in two roles. We just don't have that kind of budget and time. So can we? And I'm like, well, we can do it, but I would rather not. And he's like, okay, but I'll keep that in the back. So he had me actually write a couple alternate scenes that have me and Scott write them, that ended up not playing so heavily on the identical twin nature. And then he auditioned these kids who were, as twins, who were actually triplets. I've not met the third, but they were just phenomenal. They were both great actors, and they were both great in their own way, and they cast each brother just the right way to, you know, to play off the, you know, the menace of one and, you know, the softness of the other, and so we got very, very lucky in finding that, and so it worked out. And oddly enough, their stand-ins were also twins. We had identical twin stand-ins for them, who were these adorable young girls who are just really, they're in their 20s, but they're the same height as these, you know, 12-year-old boys. So it was perfect. And so we had all these twins running around on this set of the film, which was great for me. The reason I wrote about twins was my wife is a twin. And I always found watching the dynamic of her and her sister over the last 20 years just fascinating, and I was like, I want to do something with this eventually. And so when the Sinister 2 came to us, it was just like, yeah, let's play around with that. That would be cool.
Well, when you write, the Midwest scenery was so authentic, because I'm from that part of town, it's country. Do the art, not the art director, but the set director, I mean the set, people that build the set, the designer, that's what I'm trying to say. Do they design from your writing, or do you have to write according to what you're told this is going to be?
They design based upon the writing, and then things get changed depending. They couldn't find the final sequence was supposed to happen in a wheat field. Because I was trying to avoid corn, because I was like, look, we've got kids running around, ghosts, you know, people are up on stakes. If we put it in a cornfield, people are going to think Children of the Corn. And so we wrote it as a wheat field, but they couldn't find a great wheat field that they could get access to. So they're like, but don't worry, we found a great cornfield. And I was like, oh, but then it worked out. And but that's mostly the director, Kieran, who I believe you guys are talking to next. He goes and makes those decisions and goes, this is how I want this to look, and this is how I imagine this scene. But Scott and I tend to write very, we focus on the story and the characters and kind of left a lot of that to the imagination of the director. Some writers do that, some writers don't, but we kind of gave him a lot to play around with. So, you know, it's based on the script. If you read the script and you've seen the movie, you'll be like, yes, this is clearly what they wrote here, but we never specifically said, this is, you know, this room has a very Baroque look to it, and this has, and the desk is over here. It was very much the basics, and then let Kieran just kind of go nuts and let the set designers go nuts and create what they did. But I'm glad you connected with the authenticity of it.
Thank you,
guys. Thank you, guys. It's good meeting you.
Thank you.